Good morning, and welcome to the Friday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day.
Theresa May offers hope for EU citizens after Brexit, winning guarded praise, by Raf Kaysert and Lorna Cook from the Associated Press. British Prime Minister Theresa May promised Thursday that EU citizens will not be immediately kicked out of Britain when it leaves the Union, and says their fate will be a top priority in Brexit negotiations, prompting guarded praise from other EU leaders at a tense time for the continent. May's proposals at an EU summit were a carefully timed gesture days after talks began on Britain's departure. German Chancellor Angela Merkel called them a good start. May laid out benchmarks for the rights of 3 million EU citizens living legally in Britain and how they should be shielded from excessive harm because of the divorce. She made it clear that Britain wants reciprocal measures for the 1.5 million British citizens living in the EU. The issue of citizens' rights is especially sensitive in the Brexit talks. Under May's proposal, EU citizens with legal residence in the UK will not be asked to leave and will be offered a chance to regularize their situation after Brexit, a senior British official said. May also promised to cut the burdensome bureaucracy such paperwork can involve, the official said. No one will face a cliff edge, the official said, speaking on condition of anonymity since May made the proposal at a closed-door EU summit dinner. Merkel welcomed May's promises, but insisted that there are, of course, many, many other issues. She mentioned the bill that Britain will have to pay to leave and questions about how to deal with the border between Northern Ireland and EU member Ireland. It means we have lots left to do, Merkel said. Austrian Chancellor Christian Kern said May's proposals are a first step, but warned there are still many European citizens in Britain who would not be covered by the proposals. We are now at the start of all this, and we don't know whether it will be a sprint or a marathon, he said. The Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte said there are thousands of questions to ask about May's proposals, and questioned why the British leader was laying them out with EU leaders instead of with the Brexit negotiators. Britain's departure in 2019 will cause the EU to lose one of its biggest members and a global player, but the other EU nations were already looking at some of the spoils of the divorce. They will decide in November where the EU agencies currently based in Britain will move to on the continent, EU Chief Donald Tusk announced. The bloc's medicines and banking agencies are now in London, and almost every EU nation wants one of the two agencies. On Thursday, the EU leaders agreed on procedures for a fair pick. Discord over whether Brexit's exit process could still be reversed surfaced at the summit. Tusk said when British friends asked him if he could imagine a way for Britain to remain part of the bloc, he told them, "The EU was built on dreams that seemed impossible to achieve, so who knows? You may say I am a dreamer, but I'm not the only one," Tusk added, quoting a lyric from the late John Lennon's Imagine. Belgian Prime Minister Charles Michel, however, said the will of the British people who voted in a June 2016 referendum to leave the EU had to be respected. "I am not a dreamer, and I am not the only one," Michel said. Michel insisted Brexit negotiations should proceed without fanciful distractions. "What we also need is certainty for our companies in Belgium, in Europe," he said. "If we back this image that Brexit perhaps would not happen, it brings an uncertainty." Merkel also focused on imagining an EU without Britain. "For me, shaping the future of the 27 remaining member states has priority over the question of the negotiations with Britain on its exit," Merkel said. French President Emmanuel Macron pledged at his first EU summit as head of state to breathe new life into a European Union stung by Britain's departure and deeply divided over the best way to accommodate refugees. He pushed at the summit for joint European defense, a joint budget for countries that use the euro, and a tougher stance against the U.S. and China on trade. Macron promised to forge ahead with Germany to make the bloc stronger and more relevant to citizens. "Europe is not, to my mind, just an idea. It's a project, an ambition," he told reporters. On the opening day of the two-day leaders' summit, the EU announced agreements on extending sanctions against Russia and on fighting climate change. After a string of small-scale terrorist attacks in European capitals this week, the EU leaders also agreed to join efforts seeking to curb online extremism and crack down on Europeans who go abroad to fight jihad. They also agreed to jointly develop or purchase military equipment like drones.
Why Amazon's Whole Foods deal is terrifying food makers, by Beth Cowett. For years, Amazon has been the specter looming over retail as once dominant department stores and specialty chains fell on harder and harder times. But up until now, the e-commerce titan has managed to irrevocably alter the industry without making much of a dent in retail's biggest moneymaker of all, the $800 billion grocery business. That changed on June 16th when Amazon announced its intention to acquire Whole Foods, the upscale supermarket chain that played a pivotal role in taking organic and natural foods mainstream. Whole Foods itself may have been under duress, pressured by an activist investor and softening sales, but the healthy food movement and the meticulously curated store experience that it pioneered is alive and well. Amazon is placing its bet on the future of the food industry, says Errol Schweitzer, a former Whole Foods executive who is now an industry advisor, and they see Whole Foods as the leadership. Most Amazon watchers are focused on the some 450 stores the e-commerce behemoth scoops up in the deal. These brick-and-mortar locations instantly give it a national physical presence as well as a network of mini distribution centers for fresh produce, by far the most challenging part of the grocery delivery business because of spoilage and the fragility of fruits and vegetables. Upon news of the bid, grocery stocks took a nosedive accordingly. But Amazon isn't just trying to change how we buy groceries. Remember, the company's original disruption, bookselling. Jeff Bezos not only shifted how and where books were sold, he also changed how they were made by forcing publishers, authors, and everybody else along the book supply chain to cut their costs. The same thing could very well happen in food, and the outcome for food manufacturers could be as dire as it was for book publishers. I would be terrified if I were a consumer packaged goods company right now, says Benzi Ronan, CEO and founder of food hub management software startup Farmago. Indeed, packaged goods producers' businesses are already under stress, with manufactured food volumes at large companies declining 4% this year as consumers seek out less processed fare. And on the long-shot chance that Walmart, playing defense, swoops in with a bigger bid, the same pressures will still be in play. The overlooked asset Amazon gets in the deal is Whole Foods' 365 house brand, one of the most coveted in the organic and natural space, private label and otherwise. This is not your mother's generic box of cornflakes, with its bad design and perceived quality issues. A Piper Jaffray survey last spring found that 365 is customers' favorite organic food brand, ahead of premium names like Kellogg's owned Kashi and General Mills' Annie's. The 365 brand is virtually unavailable online, but that will change if Amazon is smart about it. The opportunity to use the 365 brand as a mainstay of their online offering is really profound, says Bernstein analyst Alexia Howard. It puts a huge amount of pressure on branded food sales. Amazon has tried to develop its own private label in food for years. In 2016, it rolled out its Happy Belly Coffee, Mama Bear Baby Food, and Wickedly Prime Snacks. These brands are available only to Amazon Prime members who pay $99 a year for free two-day shipping, among a litany of other benefits. In a sign of how powerful its private label can be, analytics company 1010 Data found that for a 12-month period ending last year, 94% of all batteries sold online went through Amazon sites, and Amazon's own brand made up about a third of all online battery sales. Its Amazon Elements baby wipes, introduced in 2014, have managed to capture 16% of online market share, despite being available only to Prime members. Amazon and Whole Foods might seem like they're on opposite ends of the retail spectrum, a relatively small, high-end grocer versus the massive e-commerce everything store, but they overlap in the power of their brands. That's a rarity for a purveyor of food. Under the old model of food retailing, the brand you trusted was the manufacturer, Ronan says. Today, you go onto Amazon and filter everything by what's prime. Similarly, Whole Foods acts as a curator for shoppers by banning ingredients like saccharin and bleached flour from the products it sells. Together, the two trusted brands should create an even more powerful one that could fundamentally alter the way grocery aisles look and even make the aisles themselves obsolete. Election hackers altered voter rolls, stole private data, officials say. By Massimo Calabrese. The hacking of state and local election databases in 2016 was more extensive than previously reported, including at least one successful attempt to alter voter information and the theft of thousands of voter records that contain private information like partial Social Security numbers, current and former officials tell Time. In one case, investigators found there had been a manipulation of voter data in a county database, but the alterations were discovered and rectified, two sources familiar with the matter tell Time. Investigators have not identified whether the hackers in that case were Russian agents. The fact that private data was stolen from states is separately providing investigators a previously unreported line of inquiry in the probes into Russian attempts to influence the election. In Illinois, more than 90% of the nearly 90,000 records stolen by Russian state actors contain driver's license numbers, and a quarter contain the last four digits of voters' Social Security numbers, according to Ken Menzel, the general counsel of the State Board of Elections. Congressional investigators are probing whether any of this stolen private information made its way to the Trump campaign, two sources familiar with the investigations tell Time. If any campaign, Trump or otherwise, used inappropriate data, the questions are, how did they get it, from whom, and with what level of knowledge? The former top Democratic staffer on the House Intelligence Committee, Michael Behar, tells Time. That is a crux of the investigation. Spokesmen for the House and Senate Intelligence Committees declined to comment on the search for stolen data. No one contacted for this story said they had seen evidence that the stolen private data had actually made its way to the Trump campaign. The House Intelligence Committee plans to seek testimony this summer from Brad Parscale, the digital director of the Trump campaign, CNN reported last week. Hill investigators in February asked the White House and law enforcement agencies to ensure that all materials relating to contacts between the Trump administration, transition team, and campaign had with the Russians had been preserved. Parscale did not return messages requesting comment for this story. Trump's press secretary, Sean Spicer, referred questions regarding the investigations to Trump's legal team, which did not respond to requests for comment. Both intelligence committees are looking at whether and how the intrusions could have furthered Russia's larger strategic goals of undermining U.S. democracy, hurting Hillary Clinton, and helping Donald Trump. During the run-up to the vote, Obama administration cybersecurity officials took steps to prepare for widespread voter registration manipulation, fearing Russia might seek to cause chaos at polling places to undermine the credibility of the election. Current and former law enforcement and intelligence officials say Russia could also have tried to use stolen voter data to gain leverage over witting or unwitting accomplices in the Trump camp by involving them in a broader conspiracy. The House and Senate Intelligence Committees held hearings on June 22nd to highlight the ongoing vulnerability of the U.S. election systems. "I'm deeply concerned," said North Carolina Republican Senator Richard Burr, who chairs the Senate Intelligence Committee, "that we could be here in 2 or 4 years talking about a much worse crisis." Cybersecurity officials testifying at the Senate hearing acknowledged for the first time the extent of the Russian effort to interfere with the election. 21 states saw such intrusions last year, a senior official from the Department of Homeland Security, Jeanette Manfra, said. None of the intrusions affected the vote count itself, all the officials testified. That has not reassured some Hill leaders. "There's no evidence that they were able to affect the counting within the machines," says the top Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, Congressman Adam Schiff of California. But he added, "the effect on the election is quite a different matter." The Russian efforts against state and local databases were so widespread that top Obama administration cybersecurity officials assumed that by Election Day, Moscow's agents had probed all 50 states. "At first it was one state, then three, then five, then a dozen," says Anthony Ferrante, a former FBI cybersecurity official and member of the White House team charged with preparedness and response to the cyber intrusion. At that point, says Michael Daniel, who led the White House effort to secure the vote against the Russian intrusions, "we had to assume that they had actually tried to at least rattle the doorknobs on all 50, and we just happened to find them in a few of them." Many hackers, including state-sponsored ones, use automated programs to target hundreds or even thousands of computers to check for vulnerabilities. But confirming intrusions is hard. As far as officials have been able to determine, the number of actual successful intrusions where Russian agents gained sufficient access to attempt to alter, delete, or download any information was less than a dozen, current and former officials say. But that wasn't the only worry. In addition to the threat to the vote, we were also very concerned about the public confidence in the integrity of the electoral system, says Ferrante. Special Counsel Robert Mueller is investigating whether any laws were broken in relation to the Russian attack. The congressional intelligence probes also seek to determine the nature and scope of the Russian espionage operation in order to protect future elections. The integrity of the entire system is in question, says Bahar, so you need the system to push back and find out what happened and why, so it never happens again.
The Republican health care bill faces trouble in the Senate. By Philip Elliott. As legislative rollouts go, the health care bill drafted by Senate Republicans left much to be desired. The Thursday unveiling, to the public and to most lawmakers at the same time, ended weeks of speculation about what Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell had been up to behind closed doors. The 142-page draft scraps the requirement for everyone to have health insurance, drops subsidies for poor Americans to buy coverage, and phases out funding for states that opted to expand Medicaid. The bill would allow insurers to charge older customers up to 5 times the rates for younger individuals, which still could be higher because fewer people would be shopping for policies because they would no longer be required, and the tax cut in it would benefit high-income Americans. The measure was shaping up to be a tough pill to swallow for many lawmakers, including a handful of Republicans who might doom the attempt. Assuming Democrats remain unified in their opposition, McConnell can spare just 2 Republican defections. And there were already 4 who publicly said they were no votes at this time, with more than a dozen as maybes. Part of the reluctance is so that each lawmaker can have leverage over McConnell as he considers amendments. McConnell's team expects to entertain tweaks here and there, but because lawmakers are using a special process that requires just 50 ayes and the support of Vice President Mike Pence, there are real limits to what they can do under the law. The backroom dealings are a headache if everyone wants a trophy. The other part is that of practical politics. Many of those noncommittal lawmakers represent states with high numbers of voters who have benefited from the existing Affordable Care Act, also called Obamacare, or worry that the bill as written would allow states to offer policies that don't cover maternity care, mental health services, or emergency room visits. Consider Senator John McCain, a usually reliable vote. His Republican-led state of Arizona opted to expand Medicaid programs, adding almost 2 million Arizonans to the health care rolls. My focus is on protecting the people of Arizona, and I am consulting with Governor Doug Ducey and seeking input from Arizonans before making a final decision, McCain said. At the same time, Medicaid covers roughly 2/3 of older Americans who live in nursing homes, and 13% of his state is age 65 or older. Lawmakers up for re-election in 2018 were equally as leery about ditching Medicaid for the 31 states that chose to participate. By 2024, those plans would be cut to 0. The attack ads write themselves against the likes of Senators Dean Heller of Nevada, Jeff Flake of Arizona, and Bob Corker of Tennessee. Since Obamacare passed in 2010, more than 20 million people have joined the ranks of those insured, and voting to take that away comes at a cost. Finally, the foursome that has announced their opposition thinks the Senate version of the bill doesn't go far enough. These Senate troublemakers have strong credibility among the right flank of the GOP, but have proved tiresome to McConnell. Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, who was among the 14 lawmakers who drafted the proposal, says it needs to become more conservative. Senator Rand Paul of Kentucky called it Obamacare Lite. Both harbor ambitions to run for president again. Senators Mike Lee of Utah and Ron Johnson of Wisconsin similarly want to make the proposals more conservative. At the White House, President Trump called the bill a starting point for negotiations. At the other end of Pennsylvania Avenue, Republicans shook their head in frustration. They had walked a plank to help the president deliver a campaign promise, and yet again, the president undercut them. Then again, the bill could be pulled out from under Trump's nose still. McConnell set a goal to pass this next week, before lawmakers go home for the July 4th holiday. But the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office hasn't announced a price tag for the measure, and that poses two serious challenges. The political one is whether lawmakers want to pass a law that could cost tens of millions of Americans their health coverage without addressing other crises, such as the opioid epidemic, that is of great concern for Senator Rob Portman of Ohio. The practical challenge is that under arcane Senate rules, there are limits to what legislation passed with 51 votes can and cannot do in terms of policy and spending. There were a handful of questions outstanding in the legislation about its compliance, especially as it relates to abortion coverage that could be deemed extraneous. McConnell wants to dispatch with the legislation sooner rather than later so that he can turn to other priorities, such as tax reform and infrastructure funding, and must pass pieces of legislation that fund the government and to boost its borrowing limit. Advisors to the GOP leader say he won't call for a vote until he is certain it will pass, and as the bill's first day of public consideration ended, it appeared unlikely to win passage any time soon.
Kumail Nanjiani is the romantic comedian we've been waiting for, by Eliza Berman. Kumail Nanjiani is worried about Optimus Prime. On the first night of June, in the bunker-like PlayStation Theater beneath the thrum of Times Square, the 39-year-old comedian is on stage talking about the robotic leader of the Transformers. The fifth installment hits theaters June 21st, 2 days before Nanjiani's romantic comedy The Big Stick opens. "I thought there couldn't possibly be anything new they could do," he says of the explosion-laden Michael Bay movies. But he was wrong. Optimus Prime has a sword. We're so effed. The joke gets big laughs, but the simmering anxiety underneath is genuine. On the phone a few weeks earlier, when asked how he's feeling since the movie he co-wrote with his wife, Emily V. Gordon, sold to Amazon for $12 million at Sundance in January, he explains, "A lot of people have significantly invested money and themselves into this." The movie was acquired for considerably more than the 2006 indie hit Little Miss Sunshine, which went on to gross $100 million worldwide. "It would be great if that investment paid off," he adds. Nanjiani, who grew up in an Urdu-speaking Shiite Muslim family in Karachi, is stepping into leading man territory, where his presence is still a novelty for slow-to-change Hollywood. The movie depicts a Muslim family with a rare intimacy, the relevance of which wasn't lost on the Sundance viewers who saw it the day of Donald Trump's inauguration and a week before the president issued his first travel ban. But The Big Stick, directed by Michael Showalter, isn't about any of that. Based on Nanjiani and Gordon's real-life courtship, it stars Nanjiani more or less as himself, Zoe Kazan as a version of Gordon, Ray Romano and Holly Hunter as her skeptical parents, and Zenobia Shroff and Anupam Kher as his. It's your typical boy-meets-girl romance, except here, the boy charms the girl by writing her name in Urdu on a cocktail napkin. Then he keeps the girl, who is white, a secret from his family. Then he signs a release to put her into a medically induced coma when a mysterious illness befalls her. Soon after, she discovers he's been begrudgingly meeting prospects for an arranged marriage. The Big Stick is not about the happily ever after. It's about all the messiness that comes before. Nanjiani grew up a minority in Pakistan, where Shiites are far outnumbered by Sunnis. His mother instructed him to keep their religion a secret for fear of violence. But it wasn't religion that made him feel like an outsider. "I didn't fit in because I didn't like the same stuff that a lot of people liked," he says. "I was obsessed with movies and video games, and that's all I wanted to do." He learned English by watching films like Ghostbusters and Gremlins. When he arrived in the U.S. for college, dropping down at Grinnell in the middle of Iowa, hardly the skyscrapers he'd come to expect from American TV shows, he became obsessed with comedy. During breaks, he'd travel to his uncle's home in Florida, VCR in tow, and tape hours of HBO stand-up. Finally, his friends persuaded him to do an open mic night. It went well enough that after graduation, he moved to Chicago, land of Second City and Belushi's, and worked in tech support while moonlighting as a comic. In his early stand-up, Nanjiani resisted relying on his experience as an immigrant, but he later relented. It was too much a part of him to categorically exclude. He built an entire show around it in 2007 called Unpronounceable and returns to the topic frequently. In his 2013 Comedy Central special, Beta Male, he agonizes over his conflict between his love for Call of Duty and his frustration with the Karachi set game's street signs, inaccurately scrawled in Arabic instead of Urdu. At the PlayStation Theater in June, he mocked Twitter trolls telling him to go back to India. Do they hope I have an awesome vacation? By the time his stand-up career had taken off, Nanjiani had also broken out on shows like Portlandia and Inside Amy Schumer, and most of all, HBO's Silicon Valley, on which he plays the unlucky in love software engineer Dinesh Chugtai. He'd also fallen in love with Gordon, who worked as a family therapist before becoming a writer and producer. A few years after the acute trauma of their rocky first year had subsided, they discussed the idea of turning the story into a film. Gordon wasn't quite ready to relive it, but in 2012, when producer Judd Apatow heard the tale, the cross-cultural family, the dramatic medical episode, he agreed that it would make a pretty good movie. Being anointed a Sundance sensation brought with it scrutiny previously unknown to Nanjiani. After The Big Stick's rapturous reception at the film festival, the life he had been living in America for 20 years was suddenly deemed relevant. Until recently, he says, "I never felt pressure to represent anything other than myself. Now it feels unavoidable. Some of my people are upset, like, we want more representation, but why this guy? He's not funny or good-looking or a good actor or smart," he says. "And I agree, it shouldn't be me. But right now, along with a handful of high-profile performers of South Asian descent like Aziz Ansari, Riz Ahmed, and Dev Patel, it is him, and he's adjusting. I'll do the best I can, but I don't think anybody should have the pressure of representing a whole group of demonized people." Nanjiani and Gordon acknowledged the importance of the film's nuanced representation of a Muslim family, but when they were writing, they treated it mostly as a happy side effect. Still, there were a few points they handled with care. She was adamant that Nanjiani's family speak Urdu on screen. "My in-laws are always speaking Urdu, and I've never seen that in a movie or a TV show that wasn't them planning something nefarious," she says. "It was very important to us that my family be a real, fun, Muslim family that's loving," says Nanjiani. "But he didn't draw them that way to make a statement. He did it to raise the stakes," explains Gordon. "We wanted it to be a big deal if he were to lose them." A longtime rom-com aficionado, Nanjiani believes the form can be used to explore situations not often seen on film. The best ones are always about something more than just the couple getting together. Sleepless in Seattle is about grieving. When Harry Met Sally is about people getting to know each other over decades. When done well, romantic comedy can be as provocative as drama. "People don't want escapist, mindless entertainment right now," he says. "People want stuff that really speaks to something." Still, Nanjiani doesn't conceal his love for popcorn blockbusters of the Transformers variety, and if he has his way, one day he'll be in them, not just competing against them at the box office. But as the wheels of change sputter and creak in Hollywood, he believes his prospects in the realm of spandex suits and mechanical shapeshifters aren't exactly manifold. "I can't be Captain America," he says. Instead, he has his eye on a new comic book series, Ms. Marvel, about a Pakistani-American teen growing up in New Jersey. In his estimation, Marvel's not going to turn around tomorrow and spend $100 million on a tentpole starring a brown woman. Says Nanjiani, it's going to take a lot more smaller movies with brown leads. The Problem with Sega's Plan to Bring Retro Games to Smartphones by Matt Peckham. Remember Genesis Does What Nintendo Don't? It was Sega's cheeky marketing salvo lobbed at arch-rival Nintendo not so many decades ago, when the 16-bit Genesis star was in the ascendant. It's a line you might imagine Sega trotting out again in 2017 as it debuts something it's calling Sega Forever, a mobile iOS and Android app that plops classic Sega games from every console era on your smartphone or tablet. The world can grab it on June 22nd. Sega, tongue-in-cheekly, describes the collection as a reawakening of archetypal gaming, an ode to the deep and diverse Sega catalog, and the beginning of a retro revolution. We'll see about the revolution, but on its face it sounds like everything mobile wonks have been clamoring for, from the likes of Nintendo et al., for years. Let's check some boxes. The games are free to play, supported by ads, can be enjoyed offline, and have extras like cloud saves, controller support, and leaderboards. For $2 per game, you can remove the ads, and Sega says it plans to add additional titles rolling forward, official emulations as well as ports from all Sega console eras. At launch, you can pick from Sonic the Hedgehog, Phantasy Star 2, Comics Zone, Kid Chameleon, and Altered Beast. I don't want to be the killjoy here, because free Sega classics, even ad-supported ones, are cause for some measure of celebration, but there remains one fairly serious problem that this maneuver, candy-glazed by the allure of free-to-play, wants to gloss over. Many of these games were never meant to be played on touchscreen devices. Sega's press release doesn't get into any of that, but does state that each game will be adapted specifically for mobile devices while remaining faithful to the original games. Having played none, the only rational response can be, we'll see. But mobile's track record for retro ports isn't strong. Of the many mobile conversions of Legacy 8 and 16-bit games I've played, especially action-angled or platforming ones that require almost pixel-precise guidance, all have been clumsy and ultimately joyless experiences, whether their translators interpolate button presses with tap-anywhere mechanics or overlay the game screen with virtualized control pads. If your on-ramp to mobile gaming includes actual control pads, be they wireless or snap-on parts, then my worries evaporate. But to a lesser extent, so too does the sense of this being a mobile experience, since you're now having to drag along external controls, transmogrify your smartphone or tablet with awkward snap-on parts, or affect some sort of device TV link that in terms of intuitiveness and instantaneity is effectively the opposite of what Nintendo's managed to pull off with its Switch TV dock trick. If it feels unwise to be on the glass-half-empty side of free, know that my skepticism stems from an obsession with noticing and caring about the way function and form interact. Yes, it's amazing that in 2017 we can move about with vast catalogs of gaming's history stowed in our handbags or pockets, but there's a reason creators like Nintendo have so far avoided this particular maneuver. Either they are wrong, and plenty of analysts, pundits, have argued as much, or they're simply being considerate of that form-function relationship in a way that's worth bearing in mind as presumptive zillions of copies of Sega Forever proceed to colonize our smart devices. I'll leave you with something Nintendo President Satoru Iwata told me in March 2015 as the company was unveiling its plans to support mobile devices. He was reacting to a question about platform interactiveness and Nintendo's own preferences. I found his response instructive then as now. Let me explain so that nobody will misunderstand. I have never intended to dismiss the entertainment experiences that people are enjoying on smart devices or any other media. On the other hand, my understanding is that, on smart devices, the main demand is for very accessible games which smart device users can easily start and easily finish. These are not necessarily the characteristics that people demand from games for dedicated video game systems. Actually, this is one of the reasons why we believe that we should not port games for dedicated game systems to smart devices just as they are, because doing so will not fully satisfy the needs of the smart device consumers. In other words, even when multiple systems can run games, I believe the entertainment experiences that the consumers demand vary from system to system.
There's More Proof That Ketamine Works for Depression by Mandy Oaklander. For decades, scientists have searched for a new type of antidepressant, one that works differently from the 20-plus drugs already on the market. Finding a new option is crucial since a third of people don't respond to available depression treatments. They haven't had much luck, except for the discovery that IV infusions of ketamine hydrochloride, an FDA-approved anesthetic, can cause rapid antidepressant effects in many people with stubborn depression. Figuring out exactly how ketamine has these effects has been a researcher's dream, since ketamine is too problematic a drug to currently be considered a mainstream depression treatment. It's illicitly used and abused as a psychedelic club drug and can cause hallucinations. Ketamine can also have negative side effects when used off-label to treat depression, including unexpected changes in heart function, cognition, and respiration. Its antidepressant effects fade, so it typically has to be given over and over again, and it's not yet clear how safe or effective it is when taken long-term. Developing a drug that works like ketamine but without all the baggage is the holy grail, but scientists haven't known quite what to target. Now, in a new study published in the journal Nature, scientists have more proof of how ketamine works in the brain to trigger fast-acting antidepressant effects. This finding could help pave the way for the development of safer drugs and an entirely new kind of antidepressant. Lisa Monteggia, the study's lead author and a neuroscientist at the O'Donnell Brain Institute at UT Southwestern Medical Center, believes the finding is revolutionary in the field. Until you have a target, it's very difficult to think about designing drugs or even knowing what drugs to screen, she says. What we're suggesting is a pathway for how you can trigger a rapid antidepressant effect. In their new laboratory research, Monteggia and her colleagues studied what happens when a metabolite of ketamine is applied to a certain part of the brain called the NMDA receptor, which plays a role in many brain functions. Past research has indicated that ketamine blocks this receptor, which seems to trigger psychedelic and antidepressant effects. They found that it does block the receptor, which sets off a cascade of effects, including the antidepressant ones. But the newest and most exciting finding is that ketamine appears to block the NMDA receptor by sitting on a very particular region of it. That precise placement may be key because some other drugs that block the NMDA receptor haven't shown antidepressant effects. We think that the specificity is what's important to trigger this signaling cascade, Monteggia says. This receptor is very complicated in terms of its function, and not all blockers are the same. Much more research is needed, including studies in humans. But understanding exactly how ketamine acts on this receptor gives scientists a much-needed target to aim for when developing a next-generation drug. It also allows researchers to look back at existing drugs in search of one that works similarly. It's been very disappointing trying to develop novel antidepressants and not really knowing what to target, she says. I think people are on the right track in terms of looking at NMDA receptor blockers as antidepressants. Canadian woman demands white doctor in video captured at walk-in clinic, by Katie Riley. A Canadian woman at a walk-in clinic on Sunday demanded that her son be treated by a white doctor, launching into a rant that was captured on video as others in the waiting room accused her of being extremely rude and racist. "Can I see a doctor, please, that's white, that doesn't have brown teeth, that speaks English?" the woman said in the video captured at the Rapid Access to Medical Specialists Clinic in Ontario. "You're telling me there's not one white doctor in this whole entire building?" she said to clinic staffers who told her that she would have to wait a few hours if she wanted to see a pediatrician who is white. "There's nobody that's Canadian? Nobody that was born here?" the woman added. The woman, who has not been publicly identified, claimed that a previous doctor could not understand her and did not properly treat her son, who was suffering from chest pains. "He was not speaking English. His teeth were brown. I do not need his help," she said. The video shows witnesses in the waiting room confronting the woman, accusing her of setting a poor example for her son and telling her to seek medical treatment elsewhere. "Seeing it so openly, without any fear, in front of so many people, without even fearing that someone can report her, it was really shocking," Hitesh Bardwaj, who recorded the video, told CTV Toronto. Local police said a caller reported a woman being verbally aggressive while demanding a white doctor at the clinic on Sunday afternoon. An officer responded to the scene, but found that no criminal offense has been committed or was in the process of being committed, Constable Mark Fisher told CTV Toronto. "The clinic is proud of the quality of medical care provided at this clinic," Rapid Access to Medical Specialists said in a statement posted at the facility, declining further comment. Ontario Premier Kathleen Wynne spoke out about the incident on Tuesday, calling it a shocking occurrence. "I think we should all be shocked.
If we're not shocked, then that's a real problem, Wynn said. We have to be vigilant. You know, I think sometimes we make assumptions about how far we have come in terms of being an inclusive society. When one of these things happens, I think we have to step back and say, okay, what is going on? Why has this happened? Where is the permission coming from for such behavior? She added. There were children in that office who were hearing that behavior, and it was very, very disturbing.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.